to identify yourself and the client you represent. Now, with that, you can proceed, counsel, for appellant, and as I said, we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Diane Ebert, and I'm here on behalf of the appellants today. It's our position that the trial court abused its discretion when it awarded respondents and respondents' counsel attorneys' fees and sanctions in this matter. The trial court's determination that appellants and appellants' counsel engaged in bad faith, vexatious, and oppressive litigation conduct is simply not supported by the record before this court. This case undeniably has a long and complicated history, including a motion for summary judgment, two trials, two appeals, and a variety of post-trial motions. However, a close review of the record demonstrates that there is no support for the trial court's determination that appellants or their counsel asserted non-meritorious positions that lacked any reasonable factual or legal basis, or that unnecessarily delayed the resolution of this case. The conduct that's cited by the court, even if it occurred, and there are disputes as to whether or not it occurred, even if it did occur, did not warrant sanctions. It's our position that the district court exceeded its inherent authority by awarding sanctions, and we are asking that the court reverse that order.
Counsel, you would agree, though, that the district court does have inherent authority to impose sanctions?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely, Your Honor.
Independent of any statutory or rules?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The inherent authority that's afforded to the court has to be juxtaposed, though, against the 549.211 and the Rule 11 authorities warranting sanctions. And what I mean by that is the case law supports the finding or supports the conclusion that inherent authority sanctions should be reserved for the most egregious type of conduct, conduct that cannot be addressed through 549.211 or through Rule 11. In this particular instance,
So, counsel, let me ask you about that. Your theory is that inherent authority has to be reserved for the most egregious bad faith behavior that cannot be addressed under the rule or statute. That's the part I mean, as though there would be some sort of a judge must first pursue Rule 11 and or statutory sanctions. And that, I guess I don't know of any authority that supports
that.
So if you'd help me out.
Yes, if you look at the Murren decision, and it's an unpublished decision of this court from 2010, sanctions were awarded in that case under the trial court's inherent authority. And there's a reference in the Murren decision to the fact that it's the most egregious conduct. And while it doesn't say, as Your Honor has pointed out, that somehow it's mutually exclusive, that it's not, if it doesn't arise to misconduct under 541.211 or Rule 11, it does imply through the analysis that it has to be a pretty egregious circumstance. And I guess
Does it change the standard? Typically, for inherent authority, the standard is bad faith, vexatious, wanton, or oppressive litigation strategy. Are you saying that Murren changes that to super bad faith?
No, I don't believe that's the case necessarily. But I think what the Murren case at least highlights, because it doesn't address this issue point blank, is that in order for sanctions to have the deterring effect that they're intended to have, they should be imposed at a time when it can actually make a difference. Your honors would allow me to point out the four issues that were raised by the court, highlight.
But that seems to be a different issue in terms of the timing versus what the standard is, and what in terms of you're talking about the most egregious conduct versus what Judge Bryan just pointed out, which seems to be the standard of bad faith, vexatious, wanton, or oppressive. So that's really the second issue. But the first issue, going back, is when you talk about the Murren case, you say it implies, and first of all, Murren is an unpublished decision, so it's not binding. And second of all, it never explicitly comes out and says that inherent authority is only reserved for those cases that don't meet the rules or the statute.
I think that is correct, Your Honor.
So there isn't any binding authority that says that, then?
Well, I think that's really sort of the issue that we're left with here, is that there's not a whole lot of guidance on when a trial court can exercise its inherent authority in the context of sanctions.
But there's no case law that says a district court can exercise its inherent authority regardless of what the rules say or what the statute.
That is correct. Okay. I think you are absolutely correct on that.
Okay, thank you.
Looking, if you will, to the examples that are cited by the court, though, as the basis for its conclusion that appellants and their counsel engaged in, again, what the court characterized as...
I'm sorry, I want to interrupt just before you get to that point, because I want to make sure I understand what standard of review you're asking us to apply to those reasons.
In
your brief...
Discretion.
Okay, so that's a change, I think, because I thought in the brief you said de novo review, citing State v. MDT on page 11...
I believe that reference to the State versus MDT is whether or not the inherent authority was appropriately factually applied in the circumstance. So okay. The de novo review would be a review of the record, but it is an abuse of discretion standard.
Okay. So you're not contesting that abuse of discretion applies to the next part of what you were going to say, which is looking at what the district court was critical of. We're applying an abuse of discretion standard to that.
That's correct, Your Honor, yes. So again, looking at what the trial court determined to be bad faith, vexatious, and oppressive litigation conduct, it really falls into four different things. One, the assertion of various immunity defenses. Two, the failure to concede liability for this accident. Three, an objection that was made and an appeal that was taken for costs and disbursements that were requested by the respondents. And four, a failure to make a settlement offer.
Well, I think there's also kind of a general delay that it seems to me that the district court focused on quite a bit, as opposed to those specific issues. So I think there maybe is more of a cumulative part of the judge's, the district court's order as well. Would you agree with that?
That is sort of an overture of what's been referenced to these issues. But if you think about that in the context of what the claims are made or the issues that were raised, there's really no support in the record that the delays that existed in this case can be exclusively attributed to what the appellants did. We have a trial that occurred and a verdict that was rendered after the first trial that was challenged by the respondents. And they requested a new trial on the issue of damages, and that motion was granted. So the delays that occurred, at least for a period of time between the first trial and the second trial, certainly isn't something that can be attributed to the appellants in this case.
I just wanted to make sure you would address that as well, that there's a general cumulative delay that I see the district court pointing out, in addition to the four things that you mentioned.
Sure, I think that's fair. But again, I think that some of those delays are attributed to normal processes of litigation, including appellate review, which is authorized both on the immunity issues to be taken interlocutory, as well as after the second trial. So to suggest that somehow a party that exercises their rights to take an appeal can then be punished for that when there's been no determination that those appeals were meritless seems to undermine the process that we have in place for processing cases like this. If we look at the behaviors that were highlighted by the court, it's our position that either standing alone or cumulatively, as the court has indicated, they just simply do not justify an award of sanctions. The trial court used its inherent authority to award the sanctions. But if you look at each one of those things, the arguments that were advanced and the order that was issued following the hearing in May of 2019 demonstrates that there's just no support for the conclusion that these were done in a way that was either improper or vexatious. Let's look at immunity in particular. When was immunity raised? Well, it was raised in a motion for summary judgment in February of 2015. During the hearing, there is absolutely no indication that the court believed that that motion was improper on any of the grounds that were advanced. To the contrary, if you look at how the court spoke about the motion and about how the issues were presented by counsel at that hearing, and it's on docket number 43, starting on page 24, the court was extremely complimentary of counsel and even went so far as to say, this is a motion that when he was practicing, he would have also made. So to suggest now, 4 years later, that motion was frivolous just simply belies the record that we have in this case.
Well, I'm not so sure about that, counsel, because he said when he was practicing and referenced the fact that at that time when he was practicing, the law was unsettled. But we had clarification on that issue, including in 2014 with the Charisse case, which was a very, very similar situation in terms of the interplay of immunity, and you had a truck driver, snowplow truck driver. So I'm not sure that that
statement really... And I'll just respectfully disagree with how that's characterized by the judge in his comments to the court. Again, on page, or his comments during the hearing, on page 24, again, starting on line 6, I would have brought the motion too, just so you know. The body of law is all over the place on cases like this, and I'm basically talking to the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court from the district court level and from the attorney's standpoint.
Right. You said that was February of 2015.
And that's August the summary judge.
Yes. August of 2014 is when Charisse came out. Now, I'm very familiar with that case because I authored it.
Right. And I understand that, Your Honor.
So I understand that, but when you look at the context... That law did become settled after that point.
Okay, and I appreciate that that's the court's perspective on it. I do think, however, it's important to note that the appeal that was taken on that immunity issue didn't come back from this court with a conclusion that immunity did not apply. What this court determined in the Ayers 1 decision is that there were fact disputes that precluded the application of both official immunity and the snow and ice immunity.
Is there any obligation for an attorney in deciding whether to bring a motion for summary judgment to look at those statements and determine, or what obligation do you think attorneys have in making those motions to look at their own witnesses' statements, for example, to determine themselves whether they think it has merit?
Well, I think the overarching issue, and every attorney has this obligation before they file a pleading, is to ensure that they have a good faith basis to advance the argument that they're advancing. And I don't think there's anything in this record to suggest that that was not the circumstance in this case. There was certainly a good faith basis to assert the immunity issues that were raised in the summary judgment motion, and then on the appeal that subsequently followed that motion, again, through the interlocutory appeal process, which is clearly authorized by this court and intended to address issues of immunity in a timely basis in order for them to be effectively implemented. Does that answer your question?
Yes and no. I mean, to the extent that the district court's criticism of the summary judgment decision is that there are questions of fact that are that arise based on the driver's own conflicting testimony, I mean the snowplow driver's own conflicting testimony. The question I'm asking is, you mentioned looking at whether there's a fact question, is whether there's an obligation on attorneys to refrain from bringing summary judgment motions if a witness such as this kind of a material witness, the person who was driving the snowplow, if that witness has conflicting statements. Is there some obligation that the attorneys have to refrain from bringing a summary, even though they could?
Well, I don't know that I would say that they have an obligation to refrain. They have to have a good faith basis to bring their motion. It could be that the factual dispute has been assessed as being not material, which is obviously the measure for when a factual dispute makes a difference on a motion for summary judgment. It's not whether or not there was any factual dispute. It's whether or not the factual dispute is material to the legal issues that are being advanced.
Right, so in this case, if the dispute is whether or not he was engaged in plowing at the time of the accident, or if the dispute is whether or not he saw the car, wouldn't those be material?
I'm not sure they would be material for purposes of how the snow and ice immunity in particular had been applied before the appeal in 2014. That may have changed a little bit when it comes to the Hoff decision that was issued in 2016, but I don't think there's anything in this record to suggest that the assertion of the official immunity or the snow and ice immunity in conjunction with the summary judgment motion was not supported by a reasonable legal argument. And further, there's nothing in this record to suggest that at the time this motion was made, either the judge felt that way either the plaintiff's attorney or the respondent's attorney raised a claim that somehow it was a unmeritorious motion to be made, or on appeal.
Right, but at the time of the order awarding sanctions, the judge felt that way.
Well, apparently that is the case, is the way the judge felt. But to somehow transfer back and have a hindsight 2020 on something that was not previously deemed to be vexatious or inappropriate, and now say, well, because you lost on your appeal moving forward, we're going to say that you have engaged in that behavior, seems to be kind of an untenuous position. Any litigant...
Are you saying then... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I see the time's expired. Maybe we can wait till your other 5 minutes.
Sure. No problem.
And counsel, of course, you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Hansen on behalf of the respondent, Justin Ayers. I had candidly planned to start my remarks addressing what I thought would be one of their arguments, which is that the judge should have couched this order under 549.211. I don't understand that to be their argument anymore. I think we're just talking about whether it was appropriate under inherent authority. So,
well, and of course, we have your briefing, counsel, on that issue. So
yep.
Go ahead.
So if we're just talking about whether the judge abused its discretion under inherent authority, this is an area where the judge has said many times from this court, broad discretion. The broad authority to protect the district court's vital function to handle the cases that are in front of it. Now, we hear a lot from appellant's counsel about some of the things the judge said, for example, at the summary judgment hearing or at other hearings in 2017. Sanctions were awarded in May of 2019. This was a long case, and a lot happened between summary judgment and between February 2017 and when sanctions were issued. I don't think this is necessarily an issue the judge thought bringing summary judgment was sanctionable or even the first appeal was sanctionable. It's the continuing conduct of appellant's counsel. It is continuing to bring arguments such as immunity, such as liability, when they know they're no longer viable. For example, for the summary judgment on immunity, they say there were fact issues at the time that justified the motion. That's fine. Maybe even fact issues that they thought would justify the appeal. But by the time we get to trial, there's no fact issue that falls in their favor that justifies the continuing defense. And that's what happened. And I think that is what angered the district court to the point where he thought that sanctions were appropriate. And I would, over the 4 years of this, just point you to some of the comments the district court made. At October 2017, this is the motion on costs and disbursements after the second trial. The judge starts grilling appellant's counsel. I want to know who at the League of Minnesota Cities is responsible for making these decisions. Who is responsible for fighting every decision? I want a name. Counsel can't provide a name, says it's a committee decision. Judge says, fine, but then this is from page 19 of that transcript, October 17, 2017. The League of Cities, in my mind, has been so unfair to the court and to the plaintiff in the way they have litigated this matter, and it continues today. And part of, as I understand it, their argument in their briefs is that, you know, we couldn't have known at any time until sanctions were ordered that sanctions were coming. And certainly, again, this is in their reply brief at page 5, the judge never indicated, and they specifically say this October hearing, never indicated that sanctions would be coming or he thought our conduct was sanctionable. This is also what the judge said in October 2017. And I'm saying at this point to respondents' counsel, plaintiff's counsel, you add up your attorney's time, and for this motion, for everything other than collateral source, and if it's $3,000 or $5,000 or $500, and then to appellant's counsel, tell your group of unknowns at the League of Minnesota Cities it's coming. And you can appeal it, and I'm sure people will. October 2017, roughly a year and a half before sanctions are finally ordered, the judge says, sanctions are coming. I'm done with this. This has been going on for years. Your continuing conduct has warranted sanctions. So how they can sit here now and say...
Well, do you think that it's incumbent on the court or a requirement before the court can exercise inherent authority to award sanctions that the district court somehow make notes along the way on the record that this is... and make comments about an attorney's argument?
No. Is it a requirement? No. I think it's further strengthens the court was exercising its discretion and was carefully considering what it was doing.
But isn't there some, while not formal obligation, certainly at least a courtesy to let a party or parties know that, hey, you know what, your conduct here is not what I'm expecting. I really question whether you should be bringing this motion. I really question whether you should be bringing this action, and put them on notice that while you do point to the October 2017 comment, I mean, how extensively did the district court comment, or was it from what I saw, just a few here and there versus, okay, you're really pushing your luck now. I mean, if you keep this up, generally what we see is something more.
Sure. And I think that the argument I was going to make that I stopped making or wasn't going to now in the statute was kind of a due process one as well, which I think this is what this goes to a little bit. I would agree the October hearing was where the judge really kind of started and said he had enough. But sanctions, again, weren't awarded for another year and a half. There was a notice of motion, there was briefing, and there was an argument on that issue. So to the extent that did appellants have a chance to respond, a chance to try to convince the judge otherwise, they absolutely did. The judge still, he listened to them, and he said, I disagree, and I think what you've done warrants sanctions. So I think in a due process point of view, where they had a chance to be heard at the right time on the issue. And then just my final thoughts on just whether sanctions were appropriate. Again, the broad discretion they were talking about, it has to be egregious conduct. This is what, again, the court said in the May hearing where he awarded sanctions. He's been doing this 22 years, and this is the worst case he's seen as far as taking position on civil defense. And then he went on specifically about the liability issue where through the first trial they refused to admit liability and then got to the trial and didn't put in any evidence on liability. They just...
So let me ask you about that, counsel. Mm-hmm. And I certainly appreciate the trial judge's careful thoughts on the defendant's failure to admit liability and failure to offer evidence to contest liability. But, of course, it is the plaintiff's burden of proof to establish liability in every case. So can a defendant... And I'm stepping back for a moment from your case and say, in what context is it appropriate for a district court to impose sanctions for asserting a defense to liability? It seems that a court should be terribly cautious about that.
I agree, Your Honor, but I think in a case like this where the evidence entirely points to one side being liable and then it's not just not admitting liability, but not even attempting to put in a case on liability.
But liability was submitted to the first jury, right? So the judge made a call at some point and decided that, well, let's put this question on the special verdict form and let the jury decide.
Absolutely, and the jury decided 100% liability against.
Right, and I appreciate that, but that's, I think, gets in a way to the argument I hear appellant's counsel making, which is, the district court judge ultimately awarded sanctions with 20/20 hindsight, mm-hmm. instead of giving a sort of even-handed analysis to each of the decisions made by the defendant along the way.
And to that,
so how do you respond to that?
Yeah. I would continue the quote I had from that May hearing where the judge is specifically talking liability. On a case like this, 99%, if not 100% of the defendants would have admitted liability. I don't think this was, in the judge's mind, who was there for all 5 years of this case, this was even a close call. There was no justification.
Right, but I'm pressing you mostly, not so much on the facts of this case, sure. but in a bigger picture. So that the fact that, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting exactly with the quote you just read, but that 9 out of 10 defendants would have admitted liability in this context. Does that mean that the 1 out of 10 defendants loses their right to put the plaintiff to their burden of proof? It is to some extent, it's a right. It's not just a question of strategy, which I think, again, I think that's the subtle argument that the appellant's counsel is making, is that there is room for a defendant to make strategic decisions.
Certainly. And to that, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. The defendant obviously has the right to put in their case to the extent the evidence allows.
And they have the right to require you to put in your case.
Absolutely, to make the burden
of
proof.
That's my question.
I would respond, I would, in this way, Your Honor, if that were the only issue, mm-hmm. There wouldn't be sanctions here, I don't think. But we're looking at the record as a whole. We're looking at 5 years of mm-hmm. ongoing conduct. And mm-hmm. that by itself, no, it wouldn't have brought us here. But everything together does. My final thought on the sanctions, Your Honor, is this is an $8,000 sanction for 5 years, two trials. Now we're into a third appeal. The judge was clearly upset, but this is not a sanction that, to use a standard from a different case, would shock the conscience in any way. This is a perfectly reasonable sanction, given the length of this case and given what's going on. And with that, Your Honors, unless you have mm-hmm. additional questions.
I want to ask one more question, and that's looking at the language for inherent immunity, bad faith, vexatious conduct, wantonly, or for oppressive reasons, pursuing litigation. There's also a different characterization or different word that's used in the district court's order, and that is disruptive or disruptiveness. Do you think vexatious isn't a word we typically use?
Certainly.
So I want to make sure that word would include, or that there's some way of us to analyze what is characterized as disruptive as opposed to merely disruptive as opposed to vexatious.
In my mind, I had read disruptive as vexatious. I think what the judge is getting at is this is, again, 5 years where you're making plaintiffs fight everything, argue everything, even things you should have admitted. I don't know that he means a different standard by that, not as I read it, at least, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to come back to one of the questions that was just asked with regard to the failure to admit liability, because I think Your Honor's comments in that regard are pretty telling. One of the issues that we're struggling with in this case and why we feel so strongly that the sanctions are not warranted is that while the picture is being painted that somehow cumulatively this record warrants the sanctions, when you start peeling back some of the commentary and references that are made by the court to support that determination, they're just not factually supported individually. And what I mean by that with regard to the liability admission is Your Honor, Judge Bradfield is exactly correct.
So, counsel, just to correct you briefly, I wasn't trying to make a point about your record.
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
I'm asking questions. I'm not making points for you.
I appreciate that. But I will use that as a point from my argument to tell you that the liability questions were presented to the jury. At no point in time was a directed verdict motion granted on the issue of liability. At no point in time did the court even express an overture at the time liability was in dispute or being presented to the jury that there should not have been that determination going to the jury.
So, counsel, what was the reason that the district court granted a new trial on damages alone?
That was with regard to some a failure to challenge what he believed to be, and I think what this court ultimately affirmed, was the expert testimony that was offered by the...
Right, you didn't offer any conflicting medical testimony, did you, with regard to Mr. Ayers' damages?
No, and we're not suggesting it on this appeal that, and I don't think that the judge is either in support of his motion, that the new trial issue or that the appeal filed with regard to the new trial is a basis for the sanctions.
I understand that, counsel. But what I'm trying to point out to you, and I will say I'm making a point this time,
sure,
as opposed to my earlier question. So the question for you is, you're telling us that we shouldn't look at the cumulative history of this case and that the judge was wrong to look at the cumulative history. I don't know how a judge this judge was faced with a motion for sanctions brought by the plaintiffs. So, and the grounds for the motion covered the entire history of this litigation. So the judge has to look back.
Yes.
At the cumulative history of the litigation and consider the conduct of the defense in the case.
Yes, and I'm not suggesting that the cumulative history is not what shouldn't be considered. I'm saying that when you consider the cumulative history, it doesn't support the conclusions that the court drew. And in particular, as again, the failure to admit liability. Hindsight is 20/20 now for the court to suggest that somehow that was inappropriate. But at the time, there's no indication that, again, holding the plaintiff to their burden of proof or requiring them to support their negligence claim through a liability determination was inappropriate.
Well, in terms of when you referenced looking back with a 20/20 hindsight, I think that's probably what we would be doing because we weren't there. The district court was there through the entire proceeding. So why isn't it fair for the district court to say, hey, based on everything I've seen here, all the activities that the parties engaged in, I think that sanctions are entitled.
Again, I think that it's an appropriate perspective for the court to consider.
Okay.
I'm saying that I don't believe that that perspective is justified as the way it's borne out in the sanctions order. For example, let's go to that October hearing on the costs and disbursements. It's clear that the judge during that hearing was frustrated by the party's inability, as he characterized it, to come to some sort of resolution on these costs and disbursements issues. But even at the time of the hearing, there was a confusion, I'll say, by the court's part as to what was being challenged by the appellants of the costs and disbursements. There's been a characterization in this appeal, as well as in the sanctions order, that somehow every single cost and disbursement that was submitted by the plaintiffs in the matter had been challenged. And if you look at the record in that regard, that's just not the case. The procedure was followed to challenge a very small amount of those costs and disbursements, but that's a procedure that's authorized by the rules and that's required if you want to challenge that. You can't force the parties to reach an agreement on costs and disbursements when you have a legitimate challenge to be made. The other thing that's important to point out is on that issue, when the appeal was taken, it was successful in regard to the challenge of the $2,500 was withdrawn. That request was withdrawn by respondents' counsel as soon as the appeal was filed and after it was briefed to the court. So to suggest that somehow that challenge was improper when it resulted in a finding or a determination that the challenge was essentially correct is just not supported by this record. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The matter is now submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you very much. Thank you.